You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, my friends. How are you
Hello,
all?
Hello, Evan.
Super.
Hey, Evan. How you doing?
You all look really good. You all look really good tonight.
I don't think we've ever said that before in 400-something episodes.
Not over our computers.
You normally look terrible, so...
We finally cleaned up good enough for video.
Yeah,
we should mention
and a half years.
To our podcast listeners that we are using video for this chat so we can see each other.
Yeah, they'd figure it out eventually.
It's different because when we're at a live show, you know, we have to turn to see each other. It's not the same. Look, I am literally looking at everybody's faces right now as we talk.
And the real literally, not the fake literally.
And this is the reason why, like, video phone didn't take off.
Because yeah, nobody, I don't want to stare at you while I talk to you. I don't want you to stare at me.
We can see everyone's habits.
I'm not wearing a habit. Hey, happy birthday to Johnetta B. Cole. Do you guys know who Dr.
He's
Cole
awesome.
Is?
Dr. See? Cole? Long-time listener?
She, actually.
She's awesome.
She rocks.
She is awesome. She was actually the first African-American woman president of Spelman College, which is the oldest private liberal arts college for black women in the United States. But it took them something like 100 years to actually have a black woman as president of the college. And she was the first. And she was an anthropologist who traveled the world doing cultural anthropology with her husband and others. They did a lot of field work in Liberia and other West African areas. And she was a badass. She was born October 19th, 1936, and she is still alive. She's the great-granddaughter, maybe the great-great-granddaughter, of a slave trader and slave owner who ended up marrying one of his slaves. And it's incredible to me that someone is still alive that had that history in her family, you know, so so near to today. Yeah, and it's amazing that a black woman in the 1950s decided to pursue anthropology as a career when, you know, that certainly wasn't the sort of future that anybody expected of a black woman in the 1950s. So she's a Johnetta B. Cole is an awesome woman and I think a good role model for other women, particularly black women.
I would love to hear what she has to say.
Yeah, well, she's still alive, so maybe we could get her on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
She's currently director of the Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of African Art.
All right. Well, we're going to start the show this week with kind of a weird item. Evan, apparently you can use money to predict the end of the world.
Yes, Steve, that's true. And as the person I'm about to talk about says, we have a mega news flash. This qualifies as a mega news flash. His name is Jonathan Kleck, and he has a penchant for folding U.S. currency in very creative and neat ways to conjure up these images, which he construes as these disasters that have happened in recent U.S. history, such as the World Trade Center attacks by terrorists and so forth, although he believes that it was certainly the U.S. government had something to do with it. And the reason he's in the news, though, this week is because he has gotten a hold of our brand new $100 bill, the U.S. currency, which has gone into circulation as of October 8th. New $100 bill. He has folded it to reveal a terrible truth. He is portending events to come in our lifetime, and what he has discovered is that a nuclear missile is going to hit a body of water and release a doomsday shroud of radioactivity by which we will all go and meet our maker. Did you guys have a chance to look at his video?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Of his folded $100 bill.
Ev, what does the bill look like after it's folded?
When he folds it in a certain way, and he always, he has a an interest in pyramid shaped things. So he folds it so it looks like kind of, oh, if you're looking at a baseball home plate, it has sort of that point at the end of it. It's a five-sided image. So he folds the bill kind of that way, and you see a missile entering a body of water, and what he says are very distinct fins of the missile. And as it enters the water, it will detonate and create, you know, obviously the nuclear catastrophe that is to come. He has done something with his computer by which he's been able to sort of separate these layers of the ink that goes into the printing of these bills, and he's isolated each of these layers of ink. Don't ask me how. He doesn't really
explain
it. It's
just different resolutions that give you different kind of interference patterns on, you know, the picture on the bill.
Does it look like a bomb hitting the water, though? I mean, what did he end up with?
Well, that's the point, Jay, is that, you know, yeah, to him it does. To somebody else, you know, it could look like something else entirely.
Like
it
Jesus
all depends
on
your
cheese.
Right, exactly. And he's a self-described, and I took this off his website, bell ringer for Jesus Christ. That's the first line of his website, so very...
I feel like Jesus can ring his own bells. I don't know. That's like magic.
Yeah, so did Jesus, like, at some point decide... You know, I need someone to ring bells for me. Mm-hmm. Who am I going to get? Get that bill folding guy. Get that guy. I want him to.
How about this? His logo on his website, I found this amusing. If you want to call it a logo, is the double helix strand of DNA ejecting a rainbow, like as if it were, you know, light passing through a prism. So I think he's had a little bit too much of Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon in his past or something like that. That's his logo.
So not only does this guy interpret these images in the most ominous way you could imagine, but he also thinks that the government actually decided, okay, we're going to do this in the future. Let's incorporate this in the bill somehow so that if you fold it, you could see what we're going to do. I mean,
now I think that he believes rather that these are messages from God, that he is, these are prophetic utterances that he has been able to decrypt U.S. currency, which is like a secret message that only he has the ability to decode. Right.
That makes more sense.
In a kind of a schizophrenic way, yeah.
Yeah, it's for as much as it can make sense. You know, he's decrypted images on the $5 bill, $10, $20, and $50, and various types of the bills as they've gone through the years. There have been changes to our currency. So he's managed to come up with, things like the Oklahoma City FBI building bombing from 1995. And also he was able to fold up one of the other bills to which he says is an image of the Pentagon being attacked, having been attacked with the smoke billowing.
The little spider that was on the $5 bill, was that predicting a future spider infestation?
Or what about the fact that you can turn George Washington's head into a mushroom?
Yeah, I like that one.
Message from Jesus, possibly.
It's all pareidolia. It's all just taking these images, and these, you know, these trees become waves, and you know the buildings on their side become skyscrapers, and you know he believes he sees details that are just not there. It's just all pareidolia.
One last note is that he also takes DNA and explains how DNA is tied into the attacks on the World Trade Center, because each tower represents 23 chromosomes, which makes 46. And if you read Psalms 23 and 46, it gives you clues in regards to all this. Don't ask me. This is him. I don't pretend to say that this makes any sense. What he's effectively trying to say is that we are impure sort of creatures. We are like only half human in a sense. We have sort of this splitting of our DNA in which part of us is human and part of us is something else. So in modern terms, he's basically calling us all mudbloods.
Mudblood.
I guess it got something right.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we obviously deal a lot with people who have very fringy, bizarre claims. And sometimes it gets into that gray zone where you think, this is not just somebody with critical thinking problems, but there's some, you know, maybe there's some mental illness here. And this guy's definitely saying he's in the gray zone, I think, is being generous. But it is an example of extreme pattern recognition, you know, numerology, pareidolia. What happens when that part of our brain that likes to find patterns and connections is completely disconnected from reality? There's like no reality testing going on. This is the kind of delusional nonsense that results. And it's an extreme example of what, you know, the average person can do on a much smaller scale. But let's move on. The next news item is about herbal supplements. You guys know what a fan I am of herbal supplements.
Oh, yes.
The thing is, like, the more we learn about herbal supplements, the worse they get. Now, in the United States, supplements are essentially not regulated by the FDA, in that a company can put a supplement on the market and make health claims without having to demonstrate safety or efficacy, demonstrate that any of their claims are in fact true, as long as they follow a few rules, which make it incredibly easy to bypass any regulation.
Rule number one, do not talk about herbal supplements.
Right. So the first rule is that you have to put what we call the quack Miranda warning on your product or website or whatever. These claims have not been evaluated by the FDA. Number two is you can't make any disease specific claims, because according to FDA rules, drugs treat diseases. So if you have something that you're saying treats or cures or modifies a disease, by definition, it's regulated as a drug. So you have to make what are called structure function claims, which nobody could really operationally define. It's basically just a giant loophole created for the supplement industry, where you could say things like, you know, this boosts your immune system, supports a positive outlook, but you can't say it treats cancer or depression, even though that's the implication of the claims that you're making. And the third thing is you can't have any actual drugs in your product. You know, something that's already designated and regulated as a drug. So as long as you're not selling actual drugs, curing diseases, and you have the disclaimer on your website, you pretty much have free rein to sell, put anything you want into a bottle, any herbs, minerals, vitamins, call it whatever you want, make any of these pseudo health claims that you want, and you don't have to provide any evidence for safety or efficacy. It's essentially at that point regulated like food.
Who do we have to thank for this? Is it Hatch?
Yeah, Orrin Hatch
and Tom Harkin.
And Tom Harkin on the Democratic side, yep. So,
nice job, guys.
Steve, quick question. Let's say that they find that something that has been sold as a supplement does have some type of effect, like a drug effect later on. Do they actually remove it from the shelves?
Yeah, but that in and of itself wouldn't make it not a supplement. I mean, the claim is that herbal supplements anyway do have drug-like effects. And in fact, herbs are drugs. So that in and of itself it's just another way of marketing drugs. It's marketing drugs that are not purified, that for which we have very limited data about bioavailability, pharmacology, and, you know, where the claims for what it does are not in any way regulated. Problems with the supplement industry, however, go much deeper than that. So the reason why we're talking about this again is because there was a recent study published in BMC Medicine where they looked at herbal supplement products. They did DNA analysis, to see what was actually in the pills. And they found that, for 32% of the products they looked at didn't contain what was on the label. So if you bought ginkgo biloba, one third of the time, there's no actual ginkgo biloba in the product.
What's in it?
Well, that's a good question. So it's something else. For example, alfalfa.
Good answer.
People.
It's some other cheaper herb or plant that can be mistaken for what's on the label. So this one specific example they gave was substituting ginkgo biloba with alfalfa. They also found that 20% contained contaminants, which is essentially substances that were not on the label.
Like poop?
And sometimes like other herbs or drugs or heavy metals, you know, things that are not supposed to be there. And 21% of the time they contained fillers that were not on the label. And a filler could be something like wheat. So if you have a genuine gluten sensitivity and you're trying to be gluten free, this is a, you know, 21% of the time, one fifth of the time, this could contain, you know, gluten, even though it's
not pathetic.
On the label.
That's like utterly pathetic. Like, what do they have, the spills every day in the factory? Just sweep it up and put it in those white pills, you know?
Well, it just shows that the whole industry is poorly regulated, that the manufacturers are not verifying that what their suppliers are giving them, what they say they're giving them. You know, so they may be buying ginkgo biloba from some farmer in Europe, and they're not just checking what they're getting. You know, they're getting some powdered herb or dried herb, and that's labeled ginkgo biloba, so they put it in a pill and sell it as ginkgo biloba, but it's not ginkgo biloba.
Has anything changed?
So what are they going to do about it? Is this just going to fade away, or is there people going to actually try to make changes and say, guys, you're bad enough without actually telling us what the hell you're selling?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, it's country by country how these things are regulated. And most Western countries have very poor regulations with regard to these kind of supplements. There were previous studies showing that, around 20% or so of supplements, sold as Ayurvedic medicines were contaminated with heavy metals.
Oh boy.
Lead, arsenic. And, contaminated to the point where if you used it as directed, you would get a toxic dose. Not just little bits. I mean, actually would exceed safety limits. Sometimes there were substitutions where one herb was replaced with another one that is toxic. Right? There was actual toxic herb. Things that can cause kidney or liver toxicity.
Why are we hearing about people dropping then? You think we'd hear more of people actually dying and getting really sick?
Yeah. Well, there are reports of it. For example, around 10 years ago, there was an outbreak of a dozen or so young people, like teenagers in their 20s, getting sudden kidney failure for no reason. And they were all traced back to an herbal product, a Chinese herb, where this kind of substitution was going on. One herb with a similar name was substituted for another. And so people were essentially frying their kidneys. Same thing with liver damage. Cases of liver damage crop up and they get traced back to an herbal supplement. So when there's a big case like that, then specific products may be taken off the shelves, or may be regulated. But if you don't even know if what's on the label is what's in the bottle, then you can't, avoid these kind of problems. Sometimes the substitution results in drug-drug interactions that people are not aware of. If you're on Coumadin, you can't take anything that's a blood thinner, and you could be reading the labels, and yet if you're taking an herbal supplement, you could be getting something that's contraindicated in people who are on Coumadin, for example. So it's basically a dirty, unpurified, poorly regulated drug with variable doses, with such poor regulation that you don't even know what's on the labels in the bottle, with contaminants, fillers, substitutions, and no regulation in terms of the health claims that are made for it.
Yeah, but besides all that, it's good, right?
I mean,
my number one question is, now that this study has come out, is there like an outcry? Is there any reaction whatsoever, or they just ignore it?
I mean, the industry would like to ignore it. I mean, they don't want to be regulated. Why would they be? That costs money. The outcry has to come from the public, and we have to get through to politicians. Unfortunately, there are very few politicians who are savvy enough to see the problem for what it is. And, the industry has its apologists and its true believers,
And its lobbyists.
So science and reason doesn't have a lobby all the time, unfortunately.
So if you buy herbal supplements, all you really need to do, make sure you have a lab in your house, and so you could check out the DNA of everything that you're eating in the supplements, and then you're okay.
The other thing is that, supplements generally don't work. If you look at all the most popular supplements and what they're marketed for, whenever we get around to doing large double-blind placebo-controlled trials, they don't work. But ginkgo biloba does not work for memory or dementia. Echinacea does not work for the common cold.
I was in a meeting at work today. Everybody's getting sick at work. I was sick 2 weeks ago, and now everyone at work is getting it. And I'm just listening to all the banter. And one person today said, well, I didn't get my flu shot, but I do have my emergency vitamin C, drink mix, and my what's that air stuff? That one the teacher
Airborne.
Airborne. I got my Airborne. So I'm just going to be
homeopathic,
pumping myself full of that.
Airborne's herbal. It's just vitamins and minerals.
Oh,
it's not homeopathic.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking of the other thing. Yeah.
I'm screaming on the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, listeners, go get your flu shot if you can.
It's time.
Do it.
I hear it's a good one this year.
$20 at the local pharmacy or Target or Walmart or whatever if they have a pharmacy.
And some years the flu hits early. And if you wait, you know, you'll miss it, miss out on the benefits.
Yeah, it takes 2 weeks for it to get to full strength. And also,
how many weeks?
2 weeks. And then, the other thing is though, it's really not too late. You could, even if you get it in December, there's still enough flu season going on where, you know, it still could save you.
So if you take herbal, remedies, not only is it not doing what you think it's doing, but you could also be hurting yourself or possibly even dying from it. And how much billions of dollars every year is being spent
billions,
on this?
And 1/3 chance you're not even getting what you're paying for. Again, the only saving grace, I think, of herbal supplements is that the dose is generally very low.
Yeah.
You know, you're not getting purified, modified, active ingredients with a known dose. Yeah. It doesn't
triple your dose.
Yeah, it doesn't completely protect you because people still can get toxicity from herbal supplements. But yeah, generally speaking, you know, it's mostly a waste. And then sometimes they are adulterated with actual drugs. Probably the most common claim for herbal supplements that
aspirin.
No, is
cocaine.
Diet supplements generally have have caffeine or some caffeine analog in them.
Mm-hmm.
Herbal supplements for impotence, you know, to help men get erections, often have like Viagra in them. You know, it's just a backdoor way to sell Viagra.
Yeah, and I was just reading an article recently. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but it was about how the makers of the herbal erectile dysfunction drugs know that eventually they're going to get caught, but they also know that they're going to make a lot of money selling it. And it is just Viagra. So they'll sell it and they'll make a ton of money. They'll get caught and the only punishment is basically to pull it from the shelves. So they pull it from the shelves, they put a new label on it, and they put it out again and make more money.
Okay, it's despicable.
Yeah. Did you guys hear, I heard today, that there was some restaurant or restaurant chain in China that put poppy derivatives in their food to get people addicted to their food. And they were finally outed. The government discovered what they were doing.
I think my local bagel place is doing that too.
Can you imagine?
Well, Bob, since you bring it up, I'll give the quick scoop on this. This could be actually a much longer item, but very quickly, poppy seeds are commonly added to food in China, but poppy seeds are not addictive any more than they are on your bagel, as Rebecca points out. However, Chinese restaurants sometimes add poppy powder or opium paste to their food, and those are addictive. Those are narcotics, essentially. They're also illegal in China, and occasionally restaurants are either fined or shut down for adding that to their food. It is supposed to make the food more flavorful, but of course it also is an addictive substance. You're referring to a recent item from a few days ago where one particular restaurant was shut down for adding poppy powder to their food. All right, Rebecca, you're going to tell us about dogmatism in politics.
Yeah, a team from Duke University, bunch of psychologists, just released a paper called "Feeling Superior is a Bipartisan Issue. Extremity, Not Direction of Political Views Predicts Perceived Belief Superiority." So in the past, there have been tons of studies that look at the differences between the two dominant political parties in the United States, the Democrats and Republicans, and people who subscribe to one or the other, how they come to their beliefs, how they treat their beliefs. And by and large, the studies have found that the conservative side of things, the Republicans, tend to be more dogmatic. And so this study looked at that, but decided to dig a little bit deeper and look at the differences between dogmatism, basically how fervently you hold a belief and refuse to change that belief. And also, at the same time, they looked at feelings of superiority. So whether or not you believe that your political beliefs are better than everybody else's and how much better you feel about your political beliefs compared to everyone else's. And so what the study found was, first of all, it supported every previous study about Republicans, conservatives being more dogmatic. But the interesting finding was that they found that both sides of the political spectrum at the extreme ends, they had an equal love of their own political beliefs. So both sides basically are smug. That's what this study ended up finding, was that both Democrats and Republicans at the far end of the extreme end of the spectrum tend to feel that their beliefs are superior to others. But again, only the conservative side, the Republican side, showed a substantial amount of dogmatism.
It's, yeah, I mean, not to say that it's exclusively conservative, it's just there's a correlation.
Yeah. You know,
that there's tends to be more dogmatism on the conservative end of the spectrum than the liberal end of the spectrum. And I think they specifically define dogmatism as the arrogant belief that your opinions are facts.
Yeah.
So basically, something which you should understand is just a subjective opinion you assert is this is the way it is. It really is. This is a fact.
Whereas, I think the crucial part though is that, your opinions are not likely to be changed by any new evidence.
New evidence. That's what I took away from that. Yep.
This kind of sociological information I find to be extremely difficult to interpret in terms of exactly where the causal arrows are here. So some of the factors that I think need to be taken into consideration are...
Who's the president is and for how long.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? If I think the out party... is tends to be a little bit more emotional about their beliefs. Yeah. So, because they feel oppressed, you know, that their view is not represented in the White House.
That's certainly something that I can agree with anecdotally speaking. I can imagine that being true, but I don't think I've ever seen any studies that have shown that or that have disproved that.
Yeah. I think, you would need to do studies generationally to really get to that information. But yeah, I mean, anecdotally, remember, like during the Bush administration, there was something called post-election selection trauma. You guys remember that? People who were just upset that Bush got elected that they actually had like some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Elected and reelected, yep.
Another factor which I think is interesting is just recent, by which I mean like the last 20, 30, 40 years, political landscape. Parties tend to get radicalized when big issues are not going their way. So, for example, a lot of commenters believe that the rise of the religious right in this country was in large part a reaction to Roe v. Wade, and that the abortion issue was something around which they could rally. But that tended to radicalize that political end of the spectrum. I also wonder what the effect is of the alliance between conservatism and the religious right and the rise of the religious right in terms of, are we just seeing that the hyper-religious are more dogmatic and they are more aligned with the right? Or is it really something about the political right that's more dogmatic? I think, I don't know, if I'm not totally convinced that the data can separate out those two things.
Well, that's one of the problems with talking about this stuff in a dualistic way, Republican versus Democrat, which is the way that we think about things in the United States. But of course, if you look at pretty much anywhere else in the world, that's ridiculous. Why would there be only two choices? I think it would be very difficult, but also very compelling to look at the effect that, for instance, the Tea Party has had on the Republican Party, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and libertarians, where do they fall? I mean, I think they're on a completely different axis. And also keep in mind that in all of these studies, they're using one measure of conservatism. It's basically, if you're high if you're high, a scale, there's a test. So if you're high on this conservatism scale, then you're a conservative. If you're low on it, then you're considered a liberal. But, you know what I mean? The liberals are those who score low on a conservatism test. That's how they're generally defined. They just basically give one test and they take the high end as conservatives and the low end as liberals.
That sounds a little sketchy.
And also I think that the other, in reading lots of these studies, the thing that always strikes me is issue choice. You know, if you're looking for differences between how conservatives and non-conservatives, which is actually probably more literally true, in these studies, how they behave with respect to issues in terms of how dogmatic they are, then the issues themselves have to be very symmetrical. If you choose an issue for which conservatives are more passionate than the non-conservatives in your study, that will introduce an artifact. So if you choose, for example, immigration or abortion on the one side, you have to choose issues about which liberals care as deeply. And if you don't, like if you use, for example, nuclear power, which I think maybe 20 years ago might have been as hot an issue, but it really just isn't anymore, then I think that creates an issue asymmetry, which can falsely appear as a political spectrum asymmetry.
I personally think that this study did a good job of symmetrical issue choice, though. You know, they did ask about abortion, and immigration, but they also asked about healthcare, which I think, especially right now, is mm-hmm. one of the hottest button issues in the country. And it's something that, of course, liberals feel very passionately about, as well as voter ID laws, which is another one that I think most liberals feel very yeah. passionately about. And what the study, what the researchers found was that of the 9 issues, there were 3 issues that the conservatives reported feeling very passionately about, and there were 3 issues that the liberals felt very passionately about. So right. by their own data, you know, it does seem as though I think the issue choice was a pretty fair one in this one. But I have seen yeah. other studies that have been questionable. We've talked about them in the past on the show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I agree. Although I think 9 topics is just too small a survey, you know, to really get a good handle on. I do think it was reasonably balanced in this study, better than other ones that I've seen. Although, interestingly, this study found that opposition to GM did not correlate more with liberals than conservatives, which seems to run pretty contrary to not just anecdotal evidence, but I mean, pretty obvious evidence, you know, that liberal organizations tend to be the ones that are anti-GM. And the authors were puzzled by that. And they said, well, maybe you have to get to a certain extreme level of liberalism before that becomes an issue that tends to hew to the left. So that was one way they explained it. I also think that another way to explain it is that if you get far enough to the right, you start to get into, you know, anti-government paranoia, and GM could be seen as a conspiracy of the government. So that then both sides can be anti-GM, you know, the left because they're anti-corporate, the right because they're anti-government, but they both arriving at the same place. That is certainly the case with anti-vaccinationists.
That's what I was about to bring up. Yeah, yeah, it's the exact same thing. People on the a lot of people associate with a left-leaning pseudoscience, but
right.
there are a lot of people on the far right that are anti-vax.
Yeah, it's interesting. And just the final point I wanted to make on this was, I wonder what effect Fox News is having on this whole question, because I honestly think that conservative media has radicalized the political right in this country over the last 20 years.
Well, I mean, there are studies showing that Fox News viewers are the least informed of any other cable news channel, you know.
There's supporting evidence, but it is also a lot of personal experience.
Yeah.
Are you saying you don't sense the same with liberal media?
Well,
and the left?
I think that there is the radicalizing liberal media, absolutely, but they, I think, are much more in the minority and they're not as mainstream. I don't think there is anything on the left that is as mainstream and as radicalizing as Fox News is on the right, in my opinion.
It's very hard to find unbiased sources, which is why you have to go to a lot of different places to get lots of different views on the same story sometimes. It takes a lot of effort, and I can see why people sort of give up after a while. They don't have either the time or the wherewithal to make the effort.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've had the experience across the political spectrum of people telling me things as facts and saying, okay, let's investigate that and see what the facts are. And it turns out it's completely different. And, you know, again, I freely admit the bias of my personal experience, but, you know, I certainly had in the last, you know, 5-10 years, frequent experience of being confronted with people who were mm-hmm. absolutely convinced that they had the story and that they were told something by Fox News. And it was completely fabricated. It was completely wrong. And no matter how many times I've shown them over and over again, that's not true. Here's the, you know, you could go on the web and we could see that it's not true. It has not diminished their faith in the veracity yep. of Fox News. It's unbelievable. Because they're being
Facts
told that
are
they
stubborn
want to
things.
Where yep. does the loyalty come from?
The Fox News formula has just been remarkably successful. You tell people exactly what they want to hear. And this is, you know, I think this is all just generic psychology. We've talked about this on the show. People tend to believe things which support their pre-existing opinions, their pre-existing beliefs. That's confirmation bias. Fox News is just capitalized on confirmation bias. It's literally monetized confirmation bias. All right, let's move on to some hard science news, Bob. You're going to tell us that the universe is not quite what we thought it was.
Ooh, that's hard.
Again?
Well, if not the universe, at least the small parts of it, lots of small parts of it. This really caught my attention. This was really cool. Those industrial scientists have a new model of black holes that do two amazing things. It does away with the infinitely dense and very problematic singularity at their cores, and it also may just perhaps replace it with a bridge to another universe. So my first reaction was, holy crap, imagine that. That would be pretty amazing. But I really got to say this.
Are you saying they found wormholes?
Deep Space Nine is real.
It's real.
Yeah, right.
They have a medicine for that, wormholes, you know.
What?
Bob, look, let me cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
When our universe is going to die, can I escape through a black hole and go to a new universe?
Well, I mean, you might be able to, as far as we could tell at this point, but I mean, you know, your particles might be spewed into another universe.
Which is something.
Which is something. If you want to be like buried in another universe. Well, let me set the stage though, because I'm just getting rolling here.
Okay? Will my Johnny Cash collection survive the transport?
No. Will not survive.
Jay has the worst will. Please spread my ashes in another universe.
Live from Folsom Prison. Come on.
No, nothing you know will ever survive the heat death. So, okay. All right, guys. So stars greater than 8 solar masses. It's an amazing amount of mass. They've got so much mass that when the nuclear fires.
How much mass?
So much mass. When the nuclear fires die out in the core, there's nothing, and I mean literally nothing, that can stop the ensuing gravitational collapse. I mean, there's not electron degeneracy pressure, which keeps up white dwarfs, not neutron degeneracy pressure, which holds up neutron stars. Nothing. It's just going to just collapse down to this point, this singularity that they've been referring to. Now, general relativity says that the collapse continues beyond these levels, creating the singularity at the center with infinite density. And since mass curves space, it also must have infinite curvature. So the thing is, most people just kind of, they talk about singularities in black holes, and they're not really thinking that. It's kind of like dark matter and dark energy, in that the names are really just placeholders, if you think about it. They're placeholders for stuff that we just have no idea what the hell it is. And for black hole singularities, it's actually worse, because it really means that our theories and our laws of physics completely break down at that point. You really have to fuse general relativity, because that deals with massive things, and quantum mechanics, because that deals with very, very small things. So a theory about quantum gravity. So obviously it's very difficult to put these two together. It's going to take a really, really long time. We're not really close right now to doing it. But we can model quantum gravity in a very limited way, and that could potentially give us insights into the centers of these black holes. So even though it's not a full-fledged theory of quantum gravity, it can be helpful. So this is where Uruguay and Louisiana researchers Rodolfo Gambini and Jorge Pullin have done. They created the first ever well-behaved model of a quantum black hole, which is quite an achievement. So their model is called the model that they use is called loop quantum gravity, which you may have heard of. And this is really fascinating. It treats space-time itself like it was granular or quantized. Space itself in loop quantum gravity is seen as being woven from these tiny one-dimensional loops, 10 to the minus 35 meters, or one Planck length. This has all been leading to that when you apply this model of loop quantum gravity to black holes, you find the singularities go away. They disappear, which is great, because they were incredibly problematic, because they basically were this big siren saying, physics has failed at this point. So if this is correct, it's great news. But even more amazing is what they're talking about is replacing it. They're actually talking about a quantum bridge in the center of a black hole, quantum bridge, that can apparently lead to another area of space-time, perhaps even more, maybe even in the past or the future, or even more bizarre, it can lead to another universe. So anything going into a black hole could potentially cross this bridge and go to another universe. So it'd be funny. Imagine just your luck. You get through a black hole and you survive the tidal forces and you go through the bridge, and then you emerge in a universe where the laws of physics are so different that you die instantly. It's like, oh, well, it's worth the trip. I hate when that happens.
But that would mean that there are black holes in other universes, which are a bridge to our universe.
Possibly. And the thing that gets me about those is that you've heard of white holes, right?
Mm-hmm.
The matter from crossing through a wormhole or these bridges come out of a white hole. It's like, well, how come we don't really see white holes anywhere?
Wait, what's a white hole?
If a black hole was a gateway to another area of space-time or another universe, that this is where the matter would be coming out of. I mean, you know, if you go from one black hole to another black hole, what's the point?
The garbage chute.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we've never detected such a thing, right?
I haven't looked at white holes in a long time, but that's what has always bothered me about.
Yeah, I feel like it could be really detectable. It would be a massive amount of matter flooding into our universe.
Hello. So the problem with the idea of a bridge, as I was saying, is that you'd be spaghettified by the tidal forces of the black hole, which pretty much, you know, makes everything else irrelevant because you're still going to be ripped apart. And so the only thing crossing that bridge is going to be your tiny little spaghetti particle. So what's the point really? But still, it's still an amazing idea. And don't forget that this is all totally premature. You know, maybe this is an argument from an incredulity, perhaps, but I don't know how you could look at a model of a quantum black hole and say, yup, there's a quantum bridge. You see the little quantum toll taker? How do you interpret the mathematics as a bridge to another universe? I guess I just don't know enough about it, but I'm just surprised that they're tossing that around without something that show me where it says that this is a bridge to another area of space-time or another universe. Still, I hope it's true because not only would it be cool as hell, but it also solves a host of other black hole problems. For one is black hole information loss, and I could tell from the look on Steve's face that I'm done at this point. So Google that, and that's really cool too. So there you go.
This video chat's paying off already.
And this was your quickie with Bob.
All right, thanks, Bob. All right, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
I will play for you last week's Who's That Noisy, and here we go. Okay, so thoughts?
Category -1, hurricane.
Whale fart.
Avalanche.
Oh, no, but you're getting maybe a little closer.
Faintly like a plane, maybe, going overhead.
Interesting that you said overhead, Jay. I'll probably give you that as being the closest. So what that was, and the hint I gave last week, is that this is an audio recording of an event that took place earlier this year. And if you remember back on February 15th, over the Ural Mountains, with the meteor, space rock that exploded, lots of footage of broken windows and people looking up in the sky going, what the hell was that? So that was quite a loud event, actually. That was a recording of the event picked up by a nuclear explosion station in Antarctica, by which it's one of the detection stations that monitors the globe for nuclear explosions. And 9,000 miles away, this was the recording that they got in Antarctica. Now, this recording, it was the shockwave that traveled around the planet. But the shockwave itself was not audible to the human ear. But the very sensitive equipment that the nuclear test watchdogs, they are known as the... it's called the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. Their devices did pick it up and got a recording of it. And that's exactly what the devices recorded.
Neat.
Interesting timing, Evan. I heard today that the Russians actually pulled out a big chunk of that meteor from the body of water that a lot of it went into. So that was cool.
That's cool. We'll know more about it hopefully very soon. Yes, Steve, several people were correct. And this week's winner is War-Torn Hero from the message boards, who guessed that correctly. Congratulations, War-Torn Hero. Your name goes into the end-of-year drawing, in which we take all the Who's That Noisy winners from the year, and we're going to draw one name from all the winners, and that grand prize winner is going to join us next year for an episode of Science or Fiction on an upcoming SGU. So, congratulations. Well done.
And therefore,
we have a new noisy for this week. You guys might recognize this one. Let's play it.
You haven't heard of the Millennium Falcon? It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
Han Solo.
Didn't sound like him.
In a community theater production.
A Harrison Ford's screen test for the Star Wars movie, yeah. Maybe? No. But it's someone having to do with the certainly with the world of science. So I think many listeners will get this one correct. Go ahead and submit your answer via email to WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or like Warren Torn Hero, go on to our message boards at sguforums.com and post your answer there under the Who's That Noisy subcategory. And good luck, everyone.
Well, let's go on to a couple of emails this week. The first one comes from Matt in Washington, D.C., and Matt writes, "Greetings and thank you for the best podcast ever created." It's a good way to start an email.
You're welcome.
"In addition to a wonderful listening experience, I also have learned a great deal about how to teach my 4.5-year-old daughter about science. Background for question, I was really charged with cooling drinks for a party at our house and completely dropped the ball. We had all warm drinks in August in D.C. and folks started arriving. My wife was irked, to say the least, and I forgot about this. My buddy, who had already arrived, told me to put the drinks in the freezer and pack frozen veggies around the various bottles and cans, which I dutifully did without thinking at first. Question, did packing frozen veggies and such around the drinks so that they made contact with the cans and bottles, as opposed to the drinks simply sitting in an empty rack, make any difference? If so, how and why? Isn't the air in the freezer and all contents more or less exactly the same temperature? Thanks. My apologies in advance, but I did not have time to research any answer via the internet."
There was a video that John Green did for Mental Floss just this past week, I think, where he was testing various life hacks that are passed around the internet.
One
of them was, if you soak a paper towel in water and wrap it around a bottle of beer, soda, or whatever, and then you put that in the freezer, it will turn freezing cold in something like 8 minutes. And he tested it, and mm-hmm. he found that he said it worked, that he took out the beer and tasted it, and he said it was ice cold. But I was really disappointed because he didn't also put in a bottle that was not wrapped in a paper
towel.
Didn't
do a control.
Sure, yeah, you need a control.
No control. Right? What the hell?
So
I have no control.
I have not gotten around to replicating the study yet.
The answer is that the more that's in contact at the temperature, the more solid it is, the better. So like if you were to immerse something in ice water,
mm-hmm.
it would get colder a lot faster than it just coming in contact with the air molecules, because there's a lot more material that it's touching. So the answer to the question is yes. If you pack the freezer bags around it, it's going to cool off a lot faster.
Think about frozen vegetables, though. They're in this very solid state. They don't really wrap around things. I mean, they might press up against certain surfaces of round containers, say, that do hold beverages and so forth. So there's a lot of sort of pockets there of air that it get in. I'm not sure you would get any kind of real optimal or any effect from the vegetables, unless they were really tight.
I agree with both of you guys. I think that, it would be better if it was a more tight wrapping, but I think it would definitely have a measurable difference, because it reminds me totally of firewalking. Why is firewalking even possible? And so it's because of the heat capacity and the transfer of heat from the coals to the human body. Because I would suspect that the frozen vegetables would be able to transfer the heat away from the object they're surrounding much more efficiently than just the plain air would be. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same reason why if you preheat your oven to 300 degrees, you can stick your hand in there, no problem, right? Even though it's 300 degrees. But you touch any metal and bam, you're totally fried. Why? Because of the heat capacity of the metal, and the transfer rate is so much greater. So I would say that it would make a difference that would be measurable. It would be of a benefit. I just don't know how much, considering how efficiently you wrap it.
And I'd say some frozen peas would wrap around a bottle pretty easily.
Yeah, like, peas,
they don't
the
freeze solid
choice.
Usually. They're, you know, a corner.
Or you could break them apart even if they do stick together a little bit. So yeah, it has to do with thermal conductance and thermal capacity. Air has very low of both. It doesn't hold on to much heat and it conducts it very slowly. The thermal conductance of air is about 0.024. The thermal conductance of water is about 20 times that. It's
0.024 what?
That's watts per meter Kelvin. So water is about 0.58 and ice is a little bit over 2. Air is about the worst possible thing, you know, to use to cool something off. It's actually a thermal insulator, it's because it's so low, it's considered an insulator. That's why you use air pockets in insulation.
Thermoses, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. Right. So if you want to cool off bottles or cans of drink, of alcohol or soda or water or whatever, the quickest way to do it, much quicker than wrapping vegetables or wet paper towels around the cans or bottles, is you want to put it in an ice slurry. Water and ice mixed together.
Better yet, an ice slushy. Choose like the mango flavor, and then you can drink it afterwards.
And when the Mythbusters did a test like this back in their show about 10 years ago, adding salt to that slurry of ice and water even increases the speed by which the containers will get colder.
Yeah. And if you do that, you can cool down a can of soda in 2 minutes.
Whoa.
Very quickly. So oftentimes, like if you're putting the soda or beer or whatever in a cooler full of ice, you have to wait for the ice to melt before you get the slurry. So if you're, and that's fine. And if you, you know, if you have the foresight to put it in there an hour or so ahead of time, but if you get caught with your pants down, like Matt did, and you need to cool those drinks down in minutes, put water in with the ice, just enough so that the water will be completely, you know, touching every surface, right? Rule of thumb, 50-50, ice to water is probably a good way to start. And it will cool it down very, very fast.
If you've got something in the microwave and it's too hot and you want to cool it down, if you could actually take that mass that you want and spread it out so that more surface area is exposed, it would be as quick as it could possibly be.
Yeah, and that really comes into play when you're trying to cool down sodas.
I know, it's not practical. I'm just throwing that out.
Well, you could pour the soda in a glass and then put ice in it.
Better yet, a Ziploc bag, a huge Ziploc bag, bigger surface.
Right.
Yes, so if you could spread it out, just to increase the surface area.
Let's move on. The next one, this is actually a Name That Logical Fallacy installment. This comes from Patrick Helms from Cincinnati, Ohio. And
take the Helms.
I've been considering an argument that I know is a logical fallacy, but I cannot put my finger on exactly which logical fallacy it is. The argument is related to the recent flare-up of the perennial Washington Redskins name controversy. The argument goes something like this. So-and-so is a member of an American Indian tribe, and she is not offended by the use of the name Redskins. Therefore, the name Redskins is not offensive. I feel like there are a few possible logical fallacies that fit, cherry-picking non-sequitur, but I cannot quite nail down which fits. Any ideas? What do you guys think?
General incredulity?
The false representative, or what the hell is that?
I would go with hasty generalization.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the core, this is a hasty generalization. It. Yeah. You're extrapolating from one person to making a general statement about whether or not the name is offensive. But I think on a deeper level that this is flawed. It's a category mistake in that it's confusing an objective criteria with a subjective situation. So, it's not really meaningful to even say that the name is or is not offensive. People either find it or don't find it offensive. If one person does not find it offensive, then that person doesn't find it offensive. It doesn't even say anything about whether or not it is offensive or not. So it's a category mistake. It's like saying, is somebody, you know, beautiful or not? Well, according to whom? You know, is there really any objective criteria? You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, you know, and so is offensiveness. So it's a subjective judgment. It's not an objective quality of, you know, the name.
It is super offensive, though.
But, Steve, isn't everything the same way?
You want to have it out, Rebecca, right here?
You know, my favorite comment about the Redskins name came from the Yo Is This Racist blog, and they said, the whole argument would disappear if they just changed their mascot to a potato.
the greatest idea
that has ever been born.
Yeah.
It's everything is subjective. I mean, is there a truly offensive term?
Yes.
Yeah. It's again. It's...
I mean, yeah. Like I think Steve's point is correct. You know, there is a difference between subjective and objective. But, you know, I also think, like, in the real world, which we live in, it's totally, like, in common conversation, I think it's fine to say that's super offensive for something that's so blatantly offensive as that. But I think it's a good point to make when it comes to the logical fallacy, yeah.
But, like, what people find offensive is culturally dependent as well. It's not only individually dependent, and it changes over time. Obviously, decades ago, when the Redskins were named, you know, at least in the majority of society,
it's
that was
still
not considered
super offensive.
Yeah, but well, it's part of it was that, you know, I guess among white society, nobody cared or nobody
right.
thought about
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
exactly.
you know, now sensitivities have changed over the years. And it's become a problem when it wasn't yeah. a problem previously. It's like, you know, the changing names for African Americans. You know, you wouldn't call them Negroes, you know, today. That was acceptable in the 50s, right? Maybe
right.
getting my decades wrong, but.
Or colored people.
Terminology changes, sensitivities changes. You know, remember when you hear all the stories about when TV was very new and, you know, people could get kicked off the air for saying WC, which stands for
water closet.
Water closet. Yeah, not even saying bathroom.
Toilet.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that are not offensive now that were offensive decades ago. It's temporally dependent, culturally dependent, individually dependent.
But we're talking, yeah, the individually dependent thing, meaning, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. Like, is it going to be something that 100,000 people find offensive? Is that considered to be generally offensive? There's infinite shades of gray here.
Yeah, so that's what the question really comes down to. Not is it offensive, but how do we decide to react to individuals stating that they find something offensive?
Mm-hmm.
Is a single individual sufficient? You know, just to take the most extreme example, if one individual says, I find the term Coca-Cola offensive because it refers to cocaine use, whatever, just making up something ridiculous. And is that
here,
enough
here come
to say
the emails.
That? Yeah, is that enough to say that, you know, okay, well, that something needs to be done so that this one person doesn't get offended? I think most people would agree that it's probably not reasonable to base any kind of policy or major decision on the subjective opinions and quirky opinions of one individual. But when an entire segment of society, or at least, you know, a majority of that segment says, yeah, you know what, this refers to our, you know, our culture or our race or whatever, and we find it, you know, a lot of us find it offensive, maybe not all of us, you know, that probably is above the bar. And again, there's no objective answer here. This is about, this is, I think, the kind of thing that science cannot answer, right? This is about morality and ethics and personal choice, and we just have to decide as a society how we're going to draw these lines and what criteria we're going to use.
Your Coca-Cola cocaine example reminded me of a brief story when I managed a magic store. We sold these pens that looked like syringes with different colored fluid in them.
Yeah,
and a little
those.
Kid came in
mm-hmm.
and asked her mother if she could have one. And her mother said, absolutely not. And like pushed her daughter to the other side of the store and turned to me and said, you should take these off the shelves right now. It's disgusting. And I was like, why? And she said, because they promote drug use. And
oh,
I was like,
yeah.
huh. They also deliver like insulin and stuff.
That's it.
I was like, maybe your daughter wants to be a doctor. And she just got angry and stormed away. That is all.
She equated it with drug use, not with
yeah. If you were selling a box of dirty needles, yeah, then that's a big difference.
With heroin in them,
lady. They're pens. These are pens.
Oh boy.
All right. So we're not going to solve the politically correct dilemma on the show today.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week in honor of our Bob's upcoming favorite holiday, Halloween.
Yay!
We're going to have four items all about bats.
Oh,
are you ready?
Bats. Awesome.
Yes.
I hope they're all actually about Batman. I'm not going to do very well.
Item number one, a single brown bat can consume 1,200 mosquito-sized insects in 1 hour. Item number two, The sucker-footed bat from Madagascar attaches to palm leaves by suction cups on its wings and ankles. Item number 3. Bats are the most common source of human rabies in the Americas, but this is still rare, only causing 1 to 2 cases per year in the U.S. And item number 4, Draculin is an anticoagulant, blood thinner, purified from the saliva of vampire bats. Jay, go first.
A single brown bat consuming 1,200 mosquito-sized insects in an hour. I agree with this one for a number of reasons. One, bats are a huge eater of insects. Without bats, we would be overrun, or I'm sure certain places in the world would be completely overrun with flying insects. So, second one about the Madagascar bat that has sucker feet and suction cups on its wings. I believe that one is also true. Other than if it doesn't have suction cups, it has bloody hooks that it uses to attach onto things. Bats being the most common source of human rabies, I actually think this one is also correct. I don't know about how many cases a year, but I just think that one is correct, which leaves me to not believe in the Draculin anticoagulant from purified saliva of the vampire bats, even though I believe that those vampire bats do have an anticoagulant in their saliva. I don't think that there is a anticoagulant taken from their drool, so I say number 4 is the fake.
Okay. Evan?
I'll also take them in order. The single brown bat and 1,200 mosquito-sized insects. I'll agree with Jay for the same reasons, and I've heard of some bats eating as many as 5,000 insects in an evening, so 1,200 doesn't really surprise me that much. I'll say that one's science. Then there's the sucker-footed bat from Madagascar. I mean, sure. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with this. If you were going to make one up pretty much out of whole cloth, this would be the one if it were the fiction. So I'll reserve, I'll leave that one in the maybe pile. The third one about, are bats the most common source of human rabies in America? Oh, I don't know about that. I think other animals might get around more with the rabies. I'm leaning towards maybe that one being the fiction. I don't think it's bats. I think it's skunks or possums or whatever other rodents and stuff carry the rabies. The last one, Draculin, an anticoagulant. I don't know what to make of this one. Purified from the saliva of a vampire bat. All right, well, I can see why Jay thinks this one's fiction as well. It just seems too science fiction-y or, you know, bad, you know, pulp fiction kind of story in a way. So I will say that it's the human rabies one. I don't think bats are the most common source of human rabies. Therefore, that one's going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
1,200 mosquito-sized insects in an hour. That's from what I can remember of actually reading that figure, that seems high. I mean, 20 a minute seems like a lot, but it's not egregiously so. The sucker-footed bat. I've never heard of a sucker-footed bat. I don't believe it possible, but I mean, they've got incredible grips, and they've got some of them even have hooks on part of their wings. But a sucker, I just kind of think I would have seen or heard about that one. And the one that really gets me, the most common source of human rabies. What the hell? I've always heard that you're more likely to get rabies from a cow than a bat or your dog. It's just very rare. And yeah, the blood thinner. Yeah, they do have an anticoagulant in their saliva, which obviously they would need while they're lapping up the blood. But calling it Draculin, I'm going to buy that because what the hell? I could totally see a scientist throwing that out there. So that'd be great. I hope that's true. But I do know they definitely do have an anticoagulant. So it's between, for me, it's between 2 and 3, the sucker-footed bat and the most common source of rabies. So I'm going to say, I think Steve is expecting us to leap at this rabies one. So I'm thinking that it's much more prevalent in South America than we would think. I still have a huge problem with it. But I'm gonna go with a sucker-footed bat from Madagascar.
All right, Rebecca, we got a nice spread.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so if I go with the 1,200 mosquitoes per hour thing, but I don't think I could do it because that seems like a normal right number to me. Like 20 a minute is that's eat. I could eat 20 mosquitoes in a minute, and I don't have bat powers.
That you know of.
like you've seen those big clouds of mosquitoes. A couple swipes through those, you could do that in 30 seconds and gobble up easily 100. So yeah, I can see that. The sucker-footed bat from Madagascar, you're saying, has suckers on extremities, but not its feet. That's the most suspicious thing about this item, is that the sucker-footed bat has suckers, but not on its feet. Suction cups on its wings and ankles. So that's a terribly named bat, if it exists. And so that makes it a bit suspicious. The most common source of human rabies, at first I was thinking that this one must be true, but then I remembered that the actual fact that I was thinking of was that bats are responsible for the only human deaths from rabies. So, Bob, when you're telling people to not be scared of bats and rabies, I take the opposite tact and tell everybody I know anytime it comes up in conversation or anything slightly related comes up in conversation how terrifying bats are in the spread of rabies. It's incredibly important that people know this. Bats tend to be rabid often, but because, bats bite you and you never know it. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and there's a bat in your room, you need to go get a rabies shot immediately. Because the thing with rabies is, there are cases, where people get bitten by rabid animals and then they get the rabies shot in time and they don't end up contracting rabies. Once you have rabies, you're done. You're dead. You're going to die a horrible, horrible death. So the reason why bats cause the only rabies deaths is because they bite people without people realizing that they've been bitten. So by the time they realize it, they've already got rabies and they die. And it's horrible. So anyway, that's my PSA about waking up in a room with a bat in it. But does that mean that they're the most common source of rabies in America? I don't think so. Not when it comes to total number of people who are bitten by rabid animals. So, Steve, actually, can I ask for a clarification? When you say common source of human rabies, are you talking about people who have bitten by rabid animals or people who have contracted rabies to the point where they are going to die?
No, any cases of rabies. It's not just dying.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think that that's true then, because I do think that there are many more cases of people actually being bitten by rabid dogs and cats. And when you're talking about whether or not it's less rare in the U.S. than in other countries, I think a lot of other developed countries have managed to eliminate rabies, like the U.K. So I think it's more prevalent here, wild animals, dogs and cats, and also like wild animals like raccoons and things like that carrying rabies. So I think that one's the fiction. I've gone on way too long for being the fourth person to answer. I apologize. Draculin is an anticoagulant. They already named a bat a vampire bat. Why wouldn't they name the thing that spits out Dracula? They obviously have a sense of humor about it. So I'm going with the rabies thing as the fiction.
Okay. So you all agree that a single brown bat can consume 1,200 mosquito-sized insects in 1 hour. You all think that one is science. And that one is science. That was the easy one in the lineup.
That's easy. Yep.
Bats are rapacious insectivores. They eat lots and lots and lots of insects. The second most common thing that bats eat is what?
Fruit.
Yeah, actually, I don't know.
Fruit.
Second,
fruit.
It's fruit. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know which one's more popular. So, basically, you have the mega bats, the big bats. They are mostly fruit eating, and then you have
they are beautiful,
like the fruit bats in the garden. Australia we saw
flying foxes.
The flying foxes, and then the micro bats are the ones that have echolocation and eat insects, basically. Obviously, there's exceptions. Did you know that there are over 1,100 species of bats? There are more species of bats than any other type of mammal. 20% of all mammal species are bats.
20%. Holy shit, that much?
Yep.
That
wow,
is a lot.
They're so cool.
That's a lot, yep. I almost used that one, but I thought that was pretty commonly known. Let's go to number four, Draculin. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Draculin is an anticoagulant, blood thinner purified from the saliva of vampire bats. Just Jay thinks this one is the fiction, and this one is science. Sorry, Jay. Yeah, Draculin, come on. Scientists have a sense of humor. Oh. They love crap like this. Yeah, Draculin has been purified from the saliva of vampire bats. Vampire bats, there's only, I think, three species. And they don't suck blood. They make little incisions and they lap it up.
They lap it up.
So in their saliva, they have both an anesthetic, so that the animals don't feel it, and an anticoagulant, Draculin, that will keep the blood flowing, so it doesn't stop. And we've pretty much figured out how it works. It has its action on activated factor X, which is
factor X,
coagulant factor. And you know, there are pharmaceutical companies trying to develop an actual drug based upon this. You know, blood thinners are very useful for multiple situations. Other animals that suck blood also are the source of anticoagulants.
Leeches.
Chupacabras.
Chupacabras. Yeah, leeches. Leech spit.
Yum.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's go back to number two. The sucker-footed bat from Madagascar attaches to palm leaves by suction cups on its wings and ankles. Bob thinks this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. Bob, the sucker-footed bat is real. But this item is fiction.
Bob.
Yeah, baby.
Does it actually have suckers on its feet?
Bob and his Halloween advantages, I tell you.
So the sucker-footed bat from Madagascar does attach itself to palm leaves, and it was thought that it did so through little suction cups on its wings and ankles, and hence the name, even though foot, ankle,
it's a terrible
whatever.
Name.
Yeah, but come on, you know, how often are common names?
It's some weird translation.
All the time.
Well, that's why I left that one as the science.
So, they discovered that it doesn't have suction cups. It attaches with sticky wings and ankles. So it has an adhesive substance, a sticky adhesive substance that it uses to attach to vertical surfaces like palm leaves. You know,
is it like a gecko with a van der Waals force?
No, it's just like a sticky substance. It's not a gecko type phenomenon. Pretty cool. Man, there's a lot of cool looking bats out there. I was looking for
1,100 of them.
Oh my God.
It's such a diverse, such a diverse group.
A lot of adorable bats too.
Yeah,
some of them. Very cute.
The flying foxes are cute.
Yeah, as awesome as Australia was, that's one of my fondest memories. And there's a lot of them from Australia, but they were to see every night, to have that show of a huge swarm of bats.
Yeah.
Just invading the city, and to drive by the trees and to see them just laden with all these beautiful fruit bats. Remember we were in a hot tub and there was a fruit bat like 15 feet above us on a tree? It was just like, just stared at it for an hour. It's just, they're so beautiful.
All right, Bob, if you want to be amazed, you have to look up the golden-crowned flying fox. That is the largest bat in the world.
Six or seven-foot wingspan?
Exactly, 6 or 7 foot wingspan. These things are massive. You got to see the pictures and videos of them.
What's it called?
The golden-crowned flying fox.
I wonder if any bats are endangered, if any of the...
About 50% of the bat species are endangered.
Ooh, that's not good.
Or in decline.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah. The golden crowned flying fox is native to the Philippines. So you'd have to go to the Philippines to see it.
Holy shit.
If you have a house in North America, you should build a bat box.
Yep.
There are instructions online. It's very easy.
But build them away from the house because you get the bat guano piles up after a while.
What are you looking at, Bob?
This bat, this person is holding a bat, and I can't believe how gargantuan it is.
All right. Number three, bats are the most common source of human rabies in the Americas, but this is still rare, only causing 1 to 2 cases per year in the U.S. Rebecca and Evan thought this one is the fiction, but this one is science. In the Americas, you know, North and South America, bats are the most common source of rabies in humans. But still, that's only in the U.S. It's 1 to 2 cases per year. And it's interesting reading about this because, like Bob and Rebecca, you have the two different approaches. There's the hey, bats aren't as bad as people think approach, and bats are a source of rabies. You know, you've got to be careful approach. And it's funny that you guys echoed the two different kinds of articles I found about it. So you're both kind of right, depending on how you look at it.
I'm completely right.
Yeah.
So am I.
If you wake up in a room with a bat, you go get a rabies test.
No, absolutely.
Rebecca, I will totally give you that. But I'm more talking about people. We're walking at night and there's bats. I'm like, oh, I'm afraid of bats.
Yeah,
I'm going to get rabies. No.
I 100% agree with you, Bob. I'm all about telling people that bats are actually wonderful, important members of our ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely.
A very small percentage of bats actually have rabies, and it is no more than any other mammal. I've read some articles found that 6% had rabies, others as low as 2%. So it's a small percentage, but still that's, not insignificant. Here's
that's
the thing.
More than I thought.
Yeah. The 6% figure seemed high to me, but that was one specific study that found that. Maybe overall it's a little bit lower. But here's the thing. If a bat has rabies, it's probably going to be sick. Now, you can't tell by looking at a bat if it has rabies or not. So if you get bitten by any bat, you should go get your rabies shot. But if the bat does look sick, it's a pretty good bet that it has rabies. So do not pick up a bat that's on your lawn, that's out during the daytime, that's in your house. A bat in your house is more likely to have rabies. A bat that's active during the daytime is more likely to have rabies. And anyone that, has trouble flying or looks sick, don't pick it up. Don't touch it. You're at a high risk of rabies in those situations. And Rebecca's correct. Two of the people in the last 10 years who died of rabies had a rabies virus that is known to come from bats, and they had absolutely no knowledge of ever having any contact with a bat, and they just got rabies and died.
Huh.
Most people know they get bit, though, because they're handling the bat, or trying to. Most of the rabies from bats occurred when people were trying to remove bats from their home. That was the context in which they got bit. And then most of the rest woke up with a bat in their bedroom and either woke up because they just got bit or woke up and had been bit. Now, in the third world, dogs are the most common source of rabies, not bats. So most of the rest of the world, it's your dogs are the vector. And they have many, many more cases of rabies than we do in this part of the world. So worldwide, bats are an insignificant source of rabies, but in the U.S., they're the most common, but that most common being 1 to 2 cases per year. So good job, Bob.
Steve and Bob.
Yeah.
That was a fun one. I like that one.
Well, I'm just happy that I got to talk about bats and going in for rabies shots if you find one in your
home. You got your PSA up. It's good.
It is my favorite PSA.
Jay, before you do the quote, let's give our listeners an update on our membership. So you can become an SGU member to support the podcast, to support the SGU productions and all the skeptical outreach that we do. And if you contribute at the $8 per month level or higher, you are a premium member and you get access to our premium content, extra tidbits every week, and ad-free versions of the show. Well, we are tirelessly thinking of new perks that we can give to our supporters as a thank you for their generous support of the SGU. And Jay, tell them what we've come up with for the highest 4 categories of SGU supporters.
I believe it was during the production of Ock, I mentioned that somebody's name on the podcast that we were doing a couple of secret projects with. And this is one of the secret projects that we're doing with Gary Kaziel. And if you don't know who Gary is, he is an absolutely brilliant artist who has perfected the ability to make very detailed drawings on baseball card size pieces of paper.
Photorealistic, really impressive. I mean, unbelievable.
He's
away.
A fantastic artist. I mean, his main gig is making art for the collectible industry. He'll make a series of cards that are Star Wars themed or Star Trek themed or,
Hey, he's the guy who drew the Walking Dead cards and made zombies out of all of us.
So anyway, so you're going to be able to see his work on the website very soon. But Steve and I decided to announce this now because we wanted to get the word out. So there's four different levels that we came up with. And they are the four highest levels, of course, because this is a huge perk. But if you are a $50 member for a year or prepay a $50 year membership, you will get a black and white only detailed and original monotone card that's custom, 100% unique for you, created by Gary. At the $75 level, there'll be limited color. It'll look similar to the black and white, but there'll also be colors mixed in. It won't be fully rendered in color, but it's going to still be a wonderful piece of artwork. At the $100 level, it'll be a fully rendered color drawing. It's the highest level of detail that he could do with full color palette. And at the $200 level, fully rendered color, custom drawing, same as the $100 level, but the subject of the art can now be changed to be you or anybody or anything that you want, and you're going to be able to spend time with Gary to work out the details of what it is. As an example, he could make you a zombie like he did with our cards. He could make you a Star Wars character.
Sith Lord.
One of the examples he showed me was a stormtrooper with their helmet off, like they're holding their helmet and the gun, and it's actually somebody that wanted this. So we'll have examples of these up.
And also, just so there's no mistake, these perks apply to existing members. So if you already signed up at this level, you will get one of these cards once you've been a member for 1 year. So this is retroactive in a way. And this is also a limited time offer. So this, you have to have become a member prior to January 1st, 2014, to qualify for this particular perk. These also make wonderful gifts if you're looking for something unique to give to somebody who enjoys the show and enjoys science fiction or would appreciate this kind of artwork. And these are all unique, one-of-a-kind cards. They will be signed by Gary, and there's also a place to be signed by all the cast of the SGU if you wish us to do so. All right, Jay, let's get on with our quote.
All right, this quote is from a man named Paul Krugman. Does anybody know who Paul is?
He's an economist.
Jay, Paul Krugman gave a lecture to the New England Skeptical Society before he was famous.
Wow. Well,
holy shit.
Yeah, Rebecca's right. He's a columnist for an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He is an American economist, a professor of economics and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. This quote was sent in by a listener named John Karabic. I hope I pronounced your name correctly, John. I'm sorry if I didn't, from Cincinnati, Ohio. And the quote is, "Academic credentials are neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for having your ideas taken seriously. If a famous professor repeatedly says stupid things, then tries to claim he never said them, there's no rule against calling him a mendacious idiot, and no special qualifications required to make that pronouncement other than doing your own homework. Conversely, if someone without formal credentials consistently makes trenchant, insightful observations, he or she has earned the right to be taken seriously, regardless of background."
Paul Krugman!
All right, thanks, Jay. And thank you for joining me all this week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Certainly.
Thanks, Steve.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.